Hello, and welcome to What is Innovation? The podcast that explores the reality of a word that is in danger of losing its meaning altogether. This podcast is produced by Outlast Consulting, LLC, a boutique consultancy that helps companies use innovation principles to solve their toughest business problems. I'm your host, Jared Simmons, and I'm so excited to have Jeff Goins. Jeff Goins is a writer, keynote speaker, and entrepreneur with a reputation for challenging the status quo. He is the best-selling author of 5 books, including The Art of Work and Real Artists Don't Starve. His award-winning blog, GoinsWriter.com, is visited by millions of people every year, and his work has been featured in The Washington Post, USA Today, Entrepreneur, Forbes, Psychology Today, Business Insider, Time, and many others. He is the creative force behind the ghostwriting agency, Fresh Complaint. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. I am so excited to talk to you and hear your thoughts on innovation.
Happy to be here, Jared. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's dive right in. What, in your mind, is innovation?
I think innovation is the act of making things new, taking something that's been done before and doing it differently or doing it better.
Got it. The act of making things new. That's interesting because the act of making things new sounds different from the act of making new things.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking of the etymology.
Yeah.
Innovate.
Mm-hmm.
Making things new, making new things. I don't think you make new things. I don't think that's a thing.
Mm.
I don't think there's anything new under the sun. Historian Will Durant said, "Nothing is new except arrangement."
Oh.
Which is like an old school way of saying everything is a remix.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is one of the leading historians of Western history, Will Durant, incredible, well-respected historian.
Mm.
Nothing is new except arrangement. And so innovation, I think at its core, is actually the act of taking the raw material that we're all given, whatever that looks like in your space, and doing something different with it. And I think when you make things new, you make a new thing.
Mm, I see. Okay. So a new thing is the outcome of making things new.
I mean, it has to be. That's just physics. The shirt you're wearing came from a cotton plant, which like came from stardust, just like you.
Right.
So it seems to me that innovators, professional innovators, are very humble in the sense that they understand that what they're actually doing is like transmuting, you know, transforming, changing the shape of something from one form into another. But nobody who like turns water into ice would ever be so brazen as to say, "I created ice."
Right.
And I think that smart, intelligent innovators understand that they're not creating anything actually. They're taking a bunch of stuff and like remixing it, recombining it in new and interesting ways. And I'm sure there's some narcissists out there that think they're making something brand new, but
right.
Not my view. I don't think that's how it works.
I can agree with you on that. I wonder if that humility plays a role in innovation from an efficacy standpoint. So I wonder if being humble makes you a better innovator, or if it's just a trait of innovators.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that you could call a younger Steve Jobs particularly humble.
Mm-hmm.
But the act of innovating is a humbling exercise in the sense that you're working with the same stuff everybody else is working with.
Right.
Like I said, it takes a real narcissist to think that they created any of that stuff. And Jobs is iconically famous for taking other people's stuff and recombining them into something new and interesting. And everybody goes, "Well, isn't that interesting? It's brand new. Wow." But like nothing about, I mean, the Macintosh was really kind of the big breakthrough of Apple.
Right.
And none of it was particularly proprietary to Apple, except maybe the closed system approach, which was a brand new way of building a personal computer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they stole the mouse from
Xerox,
as well as the graphic user interface. I mean, it was all just borrowed from other people. And there's that famous fight that Jobs and Gates had where Apple basically invented Windows, right?
Mm.
And I mean, sort of, you know, they borrowed it and repackaged it from Xerox.
Yep.
And Jobs said to Gates, you know, you stole from us. And, you know, Bill Gates, or so the story goes, said, the way I see it, you know, we both had a rich neighbor in our neighborhood named Xerox. And when I broke into his house to steal his TV, I found that you had already stolen his stereo. That's how it goes. So are they humble people? I mean, they're just people. I'm sure they're from humble to arrogant, you know, full spectrum.
Right.
I would say, for whatever it's worth, that because the act of innovating is inherently humbling, again, what I mean by that is you're down to earth. You're working with the same crap that all of us are working with.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of frustrating and maddening. And how am I going to do something different here? If you want to go the distance as an innovator, I think humility takes you farther, longer.
Right.
You could argue that Steve Jobs did become more humble and did become a better leader and a kinder, more generous person as he grew up. I mean, the Macintosh was kind of a failure.
Yeah.
In the short term, right?
Right.
And so I think humility allows you to have a longer view of your work. Like when you fail, you're not shocked. You're like, well, yeah, of course. And you're willing to like do the boring stuff that can lead to really big breakthroughs, or not even big breakthroughs, but just like they solve problems. Like innovation at its core is a problem solving discipline, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to create the world's next best blank, there's a lot of ego and a lot of expectation there. And there's a lot riding on that.
Right.
Versus trying to solve a simple problem.
Mm.
Most innovations are just trying to solve a simple problem. And they're boring. They're sort of these iterative, creative steps forward in humanity. And then every once in a while, you have kind of this giant leap. That's what researchers call the creative cluster, where you just kind of like a bunch of stuff happens all at once. And then there's just 150 years of nothing. And then a bunch of stuff happens all at once.
Right.
And I think you can go, wow, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates was brilliant. I mean, there is a certain aspect to right place, right time. This was going to happen no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Right.
David Letterman interviewed Little Richard a long time ago, back in the day. And he said to Little Richard, who was not a particularly humble man based on his interviews, he said, certainly you contributed a lot to rock and roll coming on the scene.
Mm.
Do you think it would have happened without you? And Little Richard goes, no. Like, the Beatles stole this from me. Elvis got this from me. Prince got this from me.
Right.
James Brown got this from me. Jimi Hendrix was in my band, which is true.
That is a true statement, yeah.
I think you need a little bit of that too. You need a little bit of like audacity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough to be humble with your looking down at the ground, thinking, oh, I'm nobody special. You kind of have to have like, oh, I've got something really special to share with the world. And the process of sharing this vision with the world is humbling, boring, doldrum kind of work.
Mm.
So, you know, innovation is like boring work meets like a brilliant mind who might be a little arrogant, a little audacious. But the process, it seems to me, is it does humble you. It is hard, challenging work. I mean, look at Nikola Tesla,
yeah,
who was a genius and ahead of his time and knew it,
mm-hmm,
and struggled with that, failed a lot.
Yeah. That Tesla example is a great one because back to your creative clusters and the ecosystem he existed in with Edison.
Totally.
Working briefly for Edison.
Yeah.
So, you know, imagine having someone like Tesla on your team.
Totally.
But Westinghouse and all the folks around Tesla and Edison,
yeah,
and that entire electrification of modern society, there's really only two names that stick out, but it was an entire cluster of not just scientific and technological geniuses, but the genius of Westinghouse and those folks to see what the potential is and to harness it and leverage it.
Well, and the money.
Yes.
I mean, the fact, they're in New York City,
right?
And there's just all this money coming their way from industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
From Carnegie, from Rockefeller, JP Morgan.
Right.
So you've got sort of these robber barons.
Right.
The men who built America, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're basically moving from oil lamps in the house to efficient lighting.
Right.
Electrical lighting. And so you've got the money to make it possible. You've got technology sort of like converging. And then you've got all of these brilliant minds kind of in the same place at the same time competing with each other.
Right.
And all of that becomes this petri dish, this melting pot that allows these things to happen.
Mm.
That in any other place with just the individual or just the resources or just the money probably wouldn't have happened.
As you're outlining kind of the role of New York in that era, I would say Harlem played that role in the 50s for music,
yeah,
for poetry, for a lot of different things.
Jazz.
Jazz. Oh, we could talk about jazz for the rest of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Silicon Valley, late 70s, 80s, 90s. Do you think we might be post that with the distribution of talent? Like, what is the next sort of place, petri dish sort of thing? Can we do that virtually?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have my opinions.
Yeah.
I think place really, really matters.
Mm.
And I think it's an afterthought. I think we think, at least in Western culture in America, it's super individualistic. And so we think who first,
mm-hmm,
and then maybe what or how, and then lastly, where. And it seems to me that where might be the first question.
Mm.
It certainly was the question for many previous generations.
Right.
And in many different parts of the world, still to this day, where you live determines how you live. Moving to the city back in the day meant opportunity.
Right.
New York City sort of represents that to the world, right? It was the place that many immigrants, most immigrants came through Ellis Island when they're first coming to the country. And some people, you know, many didn't leave New York because so much was happening there. If you wanted to get into acting, especially in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you had to be in Hollywood.
Right.
There was no other way to get into it. I live in Nashville. This is still a mecca for musicians of all kinds. And you're right in that with the democratization of content and connection, it seems that place is less valuable. And it may be that future generations will all be able to connect with whoever they need to connect with in their industry to make these sort of creative leaps happen. I don't think we know how to do that right now.
No, I'd agree. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I do.
And I do think that one of the difference makers, because everybody's on the internet,
mm-hmm,
and a place by necessity and sort of by definition is inherently exclusive.
Because it's a limited resource. It's a finite resource.
Because not everybody can live in one place, right?
Yep.
So if everybody's on the internet, but you live next door to me, or I keep bumping into you in the same coffee shop, I am going to give you and your work a certain level of preference.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're talking like collaboration, right?
Right.
This was the thing that I talked about in my last book, Real Artists Don't Starve, because I was so fascinated with the function of place in creative work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the one thing that almost everybody challenged me on. They go like, does that still matter? And my feeling is, yes, it does actually.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think, if you want to break it down into something practical, is go where stuff is happening. Go where people are doing the kind of work that you want to do. Join a scene.
Mm.
And if you can't join a scene, create one. Because for all of human history, that's basically what has happened. Hemingway wanted to be a great novelist. He had to move to Paris because that's where all of the avant-garde and modernist writers and artists and musicians were living in the 1920s.
Right.
So he had to go be a part of that scene to make all of these connections happen that allowed him to sort of catapult as an author. You know, but then you take somebody like the Bronte sisters, who lived in this very rural part of England, and their father was basically a Puritan preacher and didn't want to have anything to do with the outside world. And so he and his children lived on this like farm, this big plot of land, and they didn't really have any interaction with the outside world. And so to entertain themselves and each other, they would create little worlds and tell stories to each other. And they wrote these little books. And by the time these girls were teenagers, they had written dozens of stories.
Wow.
It would seem that they kind of did it on their own, but they kind of created their own little mini scene.
Mm.
And the sisters helped each other and kind of used each other as audiences to get better at their craft. Not like not they're kids and are entertaining themselves,
right.
You know, but in the same way that, like, what was it? Anthony Kiedis said in this interview about the Red Hot Chili Peppers, he told the story of every member of the band. And he goes, here's Flea, came from a broken home, but his stepdad was this incredible jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
And so he grew up around really good music, going to shows late at night, all this thing. And he just went through like one band member after another. He goes, we were all going to do nothing else but this, because music was a part of our lives ever since we were really small kids.
Mm, I see.
So is it nature or nurture? It's like a lot of it is the environment, because
mm-hmm.
the environment is nature and nurture.
Right, right.
Who you are biologically is a big part of where you come from, as well as who you're surrounded by. You cannot pull those things apart. Place is where nature and nurture meet.
Mm.
And it's really, really hard to understand that. But I would say, if you want to be a part of a scene, go where people are, even if it's a conference or a meetup or a coffee shop or whatever, make a connection and then use the internet to sort of amplify that connection.
Okay. So you think the nugget, the seed still needs
physical.
To be. Okay.
Because where are you going to give preference, right?
Right.
If I meet somebody in person and then they say, hey, you know, I'd love to have you on my podcast, or can I follow up with an email or whatever, I'm much more likely to say yes, because I've had some real deeper, I should say, connection with a person beyond virtual.
Mm.
And in an increasingly virtual world, there are more opportunities for the average Joes, as it were, to have a chance.
Yeah.
But because there's more opportunity for everybody, there's therefore more competition. So how do I get an edge? Deeper connection, more familiarity, and meeting in a physical place with a physical person at a particular time sort of deepens that connection. And then you can use the technology to stay in touch. I think creating a connection through some sort of physical place is really, really important. Scenes are places, but networks are connections maintained through technology. And so a scene begets a network. I don't have to live near Nashville anymore. I live out in the country because I spent 10 years building a network. And a lot of my friends have moved to different cities, but I'm still connected with them.
Mm.
The same thing happened with Hemingway. He lived in Paris on and off for less than 8 years, but the relationships that he made and some of the enemies that he made there as well followed him for the rest of his life. But once you make those connections, you have that network, you can take it wherever you want to go.
I see.
It almost always starts with some physical place.
That's brilliant. I think the aspect of joining a scene, or if you can't find a scene, creating one, I think that is sort of part and parcel to how innovation becomes a thing. And you look at companies and how they try to create a scene or join an existing scene. I see a lot of parallels to what you're describing, because there's that creative spark, that element of creativity, and that element of connectivity, which is critical if you're doing this in an organization. And I think the human intuition follows what you described. That's why you hear so many innovation labs, innovation centers.
Oh, yeah.
We're building this thing, this place for people to go to do these things. So I think it really is part of who we are.
Right.
And the other aspect of it, I think, is serendipity. Is what I'm hearing as you're unpacking this. Like, place magnifies serendipitous connections.
Yeah.
Or increases the likelihood of serendipitous connections.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Thinking of it as like a happy accident, serendipity, luck is an interesting perspective. I don't know that that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you're in a place with a group of people that all have a similar vision, call it magic, call it whatever, call it luck, call it serendipity, but stuff happens.
Mm.
And you're all there to be able to act on it together. You and I are doing this thing, and I'm looking at you and you're looking at me, but we're in different places. And I have other stimuli happening that you don't have here.
Sure.
So we're actually having different experiences, even more so than we would be if we were in the same place. but you know, I'm looking right out the window and there's nobody out there, but maybe somebody might walk by or whatever. There's different things happening that can pull my attention in different places. A shared space minimizes distraction, amplifies attention. And I do think innovation, the success of an innovation, follows the focus of the attention.
Mm.
The more you can focus on a particular thing, the better. So if I get a bunch of people in the same space at the same time, they can all focus their energy on the same space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can get into the quantum physics of it. I actually don't think it's serendipity. I think it's focused attention.
Interesting.
It is an amplification of consciousness. A bunch of smart minds are together in the same space at the same time, and breakthroughs happen in ways that they wouldn't happen if all of that attention were diffused over months or years in different places.
I see. So serendipity is kind of reductionist because of the intentionality of everybody coming to the same place and trying to do the same thing.
I think it sets up, you know, the listener to go, I'll just go somewhere and stuff will happen.
Mm.
That's a lazy, amateurish way to go about it.
Got it. Okay.
There's lots of people who moved to New York City that don't make it because there's lots of people. I mean, if places didn't matter, we wouldn't have cities anymore. And we do have cities.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, human beings understand that the more people we pack into a particular place, the more stuff happens, good and bad.
Right.
More crime, more money, the higher stress levels, nervous system states are probably a bit higher, general anxiety, but there's more innovation. Like, it's all of that stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think get a bunch of people together in the same place at the same time with a shared set of values.
Mm.
Don't have to be exactly the same, but a shared set of values and similar vision and focus it on something and see what happens. I mean, that's everything. That's why different religions gather for corporate worship and prayer.
Mm.
That's why even the most remote organization still sometimes tries to get their team together for offsites and company retreats or Christmas parties or whatever. There's something special that happens in a shared space.
Mm. Well said. And I think it reinforces the breadth of what is required, for lack of a better term, for innovation to blossom or bloom or come to fruition or come to the forefront. It's not just having a process or being smart or those sorts of things. I got this new technology or this new widget that does this thing nothing else does.
Right.
It takes more than that, and it is more than that.
Yeah, I think it requires awareness.
Mm.
The deeper the awareness you have, the more things you notice, and therefore the more connections you can make. And if our job is to not make something new, but to like rearrange the stuff that we've already been given. I mean, look, like we're talking and we could, I don't know, spend hours doing something. We would be able to go fairly deep on whatever we wanted to go. But if I were in that room with you, I would see all the things that you're not showing me right now.
Right, right.
And they may be immaterial or they may be incredibly relevant. Maybe there's a mess to the side or maybe your spouse is standing out there. Like, you don't know.
Yeah.
But if we're in the same room together, I'm like, oh, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
I might walk up to the painting behind you and like, okay, can I pull this? Can I look at this?
Right.
We can just get a bit deeper.
Mm.
I'll be more aware of things. We can get deeper. And because we can get deeper, we can make more connections. And that is what innovating is. It's making connections. And the deeper they go, kind of the sturdier they are. You're building like a root system.
Mm. I love that. It changes the quality and the depth of the connection.
Yeah. And it's not to say that you can't do that through technology.
Right.
It's just you've got to work harder to do it, I think.
Exactly. Exactly. You've made quite a few musical references since we've been talking. You live in Nashville. What role does music play in your life?
I love music. It was the first vocation, I guess. You know, it was the first thing that I wanted to do for a living and kind of did it. I've always been a creative person. I used to draw. I liked visual art.
Mm.
My dad was a musician.
Mm.
He played guitar while I was growing up.
Wow.
You know, as like a grumpy teenager and preteen, I listened to grunge music,
mm.
then got into classic rock and emo and punk and metal. And when I was 15, 16 years old, my dad taught me how to play guitar. Mm. And whenever I'd get in trouble, he goes, you can't listen to music. He goes, if you want to listen to music, you have to play it.
Oh.
And he grounded me from everything but my guitar. When I got in trouble, I could still play guitar.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I think music was a way for me to express stuff that I didn't know exactly how to say at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way for me to connect with feelings, as it is for lots of people, I think.
Sure.
And then I was in a bunch of bands starting in high school through college. And that was a way to connect with other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a special experience to be on stage with a group of your friends,
yeah,
feeling all the same thing at the same time. Music taught me more about creativity than any other craft. I don't consider myself a particularly great musician. I was sort of in a semi-professional band for a year that we toured all around North America.
Oh, nice.
After college. And we got pretty good.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Nashville and I was like, nope, you know, like not even close.
Reset everything.
Yeah. Like the guy waiting my table at the Olive Garden was
right.
Leaps and bounds ahead of me.
Yeah.
I love music. We just bought a house and we intentionally didn't put a television in our living room because I wanted to get an old vintage hi-fi system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent several months on eBay and Craigslist trying to like put together a system. I wanted to get into vinyl.
Yeah, yeah.
Been like dipping my toe in it. And every night we put a record on. We just kind of sit and listen to the Beatles or Michael Jackson or whatever. So I think music is more important than it's ever been. But music really taught me kind of the magic of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of being in the same place at the same time, you play music?
I do. Yeah. Vocals and keyboards. Yeah.
Yeah. So you'll know what I'm talking about. But like people who don't play music might not know this. If you play with a group long enough and enough, you put in enough hours and you do it frequently enough. You have to do both of those things. You've got to play for hours at a time, multiple times a week, over and over and over again. You do that and you start to read each other's minds, meaning you're playing on stage and initially somebody goes, do the chorus again. Everybody plays the chorus again and it works. And then next it's like a nod and everybody plays the chorus again. And then nobody ever has to say or do anything. You just feel it.
Right.
And you're like one organism. And it doesn't happen all the time, right?
Right.
But like you get into the flow and you're like one organism with different body parts all kind of moving together. And that's a beautiful thing.
Mm.
And music taught me so much about writing. It taught me public speaking. I was a better than average public speaker because I had been performing for decades.
Right.
When I started public speaking and I understood this is just performance. And what playing live music allows you to do, because you've got to keep an audience's attention 3 minutes at a time.
Yeah, I do know.
And it's actually 1 second. It's one note at a time. If I play it like
wrong note,
early or late, I'm dead.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly in tune with the audience. And that plus acting made me very comfortable stepping up on stage for like a book tour or something and telling a story or delivering a talk. And I think music, whether you listen to it or play it or both, teaches you really more than just about anything, teaches you to get into the moment and stay in the moment.
That's exactly right.
Ride from moment to moment, second to second.
Yeah.
The only other thing that really does that for me is just movement, running, walking, the same level of awareness, but music has this elevated emotionality to it that is hard to beat.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I think the performance of live music is so instructive, not only for exactly what you laid out. What it did for me is it taught me how to listen.
Yeah, you got to.
There's so many different levels of listening. There's hearing things. And what you're describing about being able to start at the same time without anyone saying a word or stop at the same time without anyone saying a word, or someone hits the tritone substitution and then everybody goes to this different place together. That's a level of listening that makes listening to someone speak or taking in information other ways feel so much easier.
Yeah. I mean, they say that art imitates life and life imitates art. And the lesson that music teaches you about paying attention to your surroundings, especially something like jazz.
Yeah.
Depending on the kind of jazz you're playing, it's all kind of one long improvisation. But there's like good improvisation, you know, there's like different different levels of improvisation, you know, skilled improvisation and not so skilled.
Yeah.
As is true for anything.
Yeah.
But that art form is such a beautiful picture of life.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this video recently and this guy's playing with Miles Davis and he's playing guitar or something and he hit a wrong chord.
Mm.
Dude plays wrong chord. Miles stops playing, hears it. Listen, this like pauses and then starts playing again and makes the wrong chord right. Was doing this, whatever the line he was playing, he was going in this direction, then chord hits, sounds incredibly dissonant and off. And then Miles takes it here and makes it work.
Mm.
And that's such a like beautiful picture of life because you'll have this idea of I'm going to go in this direction. I'm going to do these things. And then life is like, nope. You know, this thing happens, that person dies, you get sued for that, you get that tax bill, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff happens, we go into a recession, this person gets elected instead of that person, and your plans don't work out the way that you thought they would.
Right.
And you've got to be able to dance with that.
Mm.
As you said, playing live music is really good instruction for life because every performance is different.
Right.
And if you think your job as a professional musician is to play the same songs, the same set, over and over and over again, good luck. You'll last like 6 months before you die of boredom and exhaustion.
Right.
You've got to step on stage. This is true for actors, stand-up comedians, lots of different crafts, of course. But you've got to stand up on stage every night, ready to create the world anew again, seemingly from scratch. And you take all this stuff that you have, all this experience, all this knowledge, and you've got to put together something for tonight. For right now, for this moment.
Right.
And it'll never happen this way again. And that's so fun.
Mm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think it really, like you said, it's very instructive and it's very connected to not just creativity, but the ecosystem and the value of being in one place.
Yeah.
And all of that, I think, comes together to sort of support this process of making things new that you alluded to, where place is important. Listening is important. Being in the moment is important. All of those things are critical elements to making things new.
I think what's cool about music, and I'm happy to sort of tie this in with innovation, because I don't really believe in metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is what it is.
Interesting.
Music is not a metaphor for innovation. Music is innovation. Innovation is a form of creative expression. It is a kind of music in a way. You know, these aren't metaphors. These are realities.
Right.
And they're instructive. We learn about this piece of reality over here through this lens from this thing. You know, music teaches about innovation, innovation teaches about music, and these things can complement each other and should. When I started playing music, I started hearing music differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember the day I was riding in the car, listening to the radio with my dad, and like, I don't know, Led Zeppelin or something was playing. And I used to just hear a song as a song, like one sort of mono channel of music.
Right.
And I remember the day I could hear the bass line and I was like, oh, and listening is the act of like sort of amplifying your awareness through paying attention.
Right.
You can always notice more things.
Mm.
I mentioned recently went from listening to a lot of digital music to listening to more records on a vintage hi-fi system.
Yeah.
And I've got a 1970 something Yamaha receiver.
Wow.
That thing's 50 years old.
Unbelievable.
Holy crap. And it works brilliantly. And it's like 100 pounds. You know?
Oh yeah. I'm
it
sure.
Still works and it sounds awesome. And I've got this vintage Pioneer turntable. It's fine, you know, like and I've got these Infinity speakers. This is nothing incredible. The whole thing probably cost me $500. But it's really cool. It's all these pieces. And I'm lying on my couch the other night listening to Abbey Road by the Beatles.
Yep.
At this point, I've got a trained ear. I can hear different instruments and voices and things. And I went through the whole record just listening to every single bass line. And I was like, oh my God, Paul McCartney is like the best bass player in the world. How did he do this? It's incredible. Why did he do that thing, you know?
Yep.
And so all that to say, like, once you learn how to listen,
mm-hmm.
which you're born knowing how to do, but like, as you begin to say, pick a certain tool of attention, which is necessary to innovating.
Mm.
Like, I think what innovators do really, really well is they find one thing that they can hyper-focus on. That thing, whatever it is, can always go deeper. You can always hear more. You can always notice more. You can always see more.
Mm.
I remember recently, past few years, with COVID and pandemic and not being able to see a lot of people, I just went for a lot of walks. And I remember the day where I noticed, like, the trees just sort of dance. You could just, like, watch the trees sort of move in the wind all day long. It's incredible.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
I remember the day when I noticed that clouds don't stand still, that they move, not just move across the sky, but if you watch them, they swirl and they're these balls of gaseous liquid, right? They're like semi-solid state of floating water in the air. And so they're like moving.
Yeah.
And you can do that with anything. You could do that with your kid.
Mm.
You could do that at your job. Nothing is actually boring. Things are always happening.
Yeah.
And the more you pay attention, the more you see. And the more you see, the more you can change. And you can't change stuff that you don't notice.
Right.
You don't even know it's there.
Right.
And so if you want to be more innovative, this is why I think it's humbling work. Begin to practice the habit of paying attention to ordinary, boring stuff and find something amazing about it. Because that's how you change anything.
Building that muscle.
Yeah. You got to see the one thing that could be done better.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that requires intense attention. It's listening.
Mm.
There's no limit to how far you can go with that tool, paying attention to something.
Oh, Jeff, the time has flown by, my friend. This has been an amazing conversation. Innovation is the act of making things new. I appreciate and thank you for the journey of taking us through all the different aspects of that definition. And it's always fun to connect with a fellow musician. So thank you for your time and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jared. And kudos to you for exploring this subject. It's one worthy of our attention, for sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this week's show. You can drop us a line on Twitter at Outlast LLC, OutlastLLC, or follow us on LinkedIn where we're Outlast Consulting. Until next time, keep innovating, whatever that means.